This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. It's 1 minute past 10 and you're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. This is Jim Parr here and I'm in the studio with Patrick. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Jim. It's lovely to be here.
And with James. Hello, James.
Hi, Jim Parr.
And hello, Steph.
Hello, Jim.
And Steph is going to have tonight one of her regular scientist guests on, aren't you? We're going to be talking Irukandji, I think, aren't we?
Oh, that was very brave trying to pronounce it. I wasn't even going to try.
Irukandji.
Yeah, they're the small jellyfish.
They're really scary, really, dangerous ones.
They're like Jaws. They eat you.
But they don't eat you. They just paralyze you and make you vomit and then die. It's pretty bad.
The wonderful way that Steph says it, though, is just like, what they do is that they paralyze you and then you vomit and then you die.
But even worse, they do it in the hottest months of the swimming year. Mm. In the northern tropical waters of Australia.
So all along, you're poetic. What's happened?
So all along the Great Barrier Reef and along the North Queensland coast. So you can't go swimming a lot of the time there, unless the winds are in the right direction.
And who will be speaking about that with Dr. Lisa Gershwin?
Yes, who's the director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Services, and she's definitely a jellyfish expert, very passionate about jellyfish.
Aficionado, ambassador.
Yes. She's been studying jellyfish for over 18 years, so if you have any jellyfish-related questions, please SMS us on 0427 joy949.
I know we've already set up a couple of very interesting ones.
We have, or email onair@joy.org.au.
And later today, Jim, we're speaking with Paul Woodward, aren't we?
We are, and Paul Woodward is going to talk to us about the importance of HIV disclosure, and we'll have a bit of a talk around that issue and things like the Institute of Many and so on, which if you want to know what those things are, you better stay tuned and listen. And please SMS us on 0427 joy949 or email us onair@joy.org.au or call Robert. He's out on the front desk and he's got nothing to do and I just fed him chocolate to keep him sweet. So
he's always sweet.
So please give him a call and talk to him and ask him to bring questions into us. 1300 joy 949.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and we have our first message. It's from Scotty, who emailed us last week and wanted us to have a particular Kate Bush song. And guess what, Scotty?
We're going to do that
just for you. You might just be in luck. We've got Patrick is rushing around at the moment. He did remember, and he's rushing around trying to find what he's done with it. So it is going to be on. Is that right, Patrick? Are you going to find this for Scotty?
Of course I'm going to find it for Scotty. It's just, it's very hard to find, you know, an earth.
We're very loyal to our fans. So if you have a music request, you can make that request by SMS.
Doesn't mean that we will play it. We did play
We will play it.
What did we play?
We haven't turned it down yet.
We played
the Flying Fox song.
The Flying Fox song.
By Don Spencer, which was a children's song from the mid-1980s. So that goes to show we've yet to turn down a song. So SMS us on 0427.
It shows that I'm just a girl who can't say no. It's very...
You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 9 minutes past 10. And
we have our first guest for the night. Our first guest is Lisa Ann Gershwin, who is the director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Services. Hello, Lisa.
Hello, hello.
Hello, and welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you guys.
Hi, Lisa. It's Jim here. Did I see you on TV talking about Irukandji a couple of years ago?
That's possible.
That was you, was it?
That would have been me, yeah.
Are we pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Irukandji, that's exactly right. Oh, well, I should say, actually, depends if the person you saw on TV was like a frizzy-haired yank, then that
yes,
was me.
Yes, I'm sure it was you.
So, yeah. Lisa, you're originally from Chicago and now in Hobart. Is that right? Is that where we're talking to you from?
Actually, I am in Hobart, but I'm originally from Los Angeles. Yeah, no, a way better state, if I could just say. So seriously, like, I'm a resort kind of girl. I was born in Palm Springs in the desert. I was raised in a little town in the mountains called Valley of Enchantment.
Whoa!
And honestly, of course it was. Very enchanting. Of course.
That's a great name.
Yeah, and then I spent many years at the beach in a town called Malibu near Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of lived in all the fabulous habitats around L.A.
But when you've been working on Irukandji, didn't you, when I saw you on TV, weren't you working over in Broome or somewhere in the northwest of Western Australia? And
yeah.
You were tracking it right around the north of Australia?
Yeah, that would have been me. Look, I've worked so many places with Irukandji, and as a matter of fact, I'm actually traveling to Dublin the day after tomorrow because, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm giving a TED talk there and hoping to meet with the doctors of girl who suffered quite a severe case of Irukandji syndrome in Ireland just a couple of weeks ago. So Irukandjis have definitely taken me a lot of places, including Thailand and Malaysia and right around Australia.
Are they the same things in Ireland as they are in the Australian waters? Like they must be, is Irukandji just a generic name for a type
you hit it right on the nose. It's a generic name for creatures who cause Irukandji syndrome. So, you know, they can be different species, but they're still jellyfish. So,
nasty, stinging things.
So maybe we should start from the start. Could you tell people a little bit about Irukandji and what they are and why they're so dangerous and what's so interesting about them?
Oh, absolutely. Look, what can I say? They are evil little bastards. can I say that?
You can say it.
You can use that. The F-bomb, if you like.
We wouldn't recommend it, let me point out.
But you can if you
will. But the B-bomb is okay, is that right?
That's perfectly legitimate. We're not in the US now, you know. You're in a civilized country.
This is why we like the 10 p.m. slot.
I love it. So,
they're evil little bastards.
They are. So most of the species are quite small. And, you know, we measure them in comparison to the pinky fingernail or the thumb fingernail or the first joint on your thumb or, you know, things like that. They're all quite small, except I recently named and classified yet another new species that's actually measured in length of the arm rather than the fingernail. But that's another story. So most of the species are quite small and very invisible in water, and they're like a thimble shape with four tentacles coming off the bottom of the body. And the tentacles are quite quite fine and, you know, just really sort of nothing much there.
And they're the dangerous bit, aren't they?
That's the dangerous bit. Well, actually, I should say, we think that's the dangerous bit, but believe it or not, we don't actually know if it's the tentacles or the body or both that causes the syndrome.
I was going to ask you a question about eating jellyfish in that case. So you mean it might be a little bit dangerous?
Don't eat Irukandjis. Yeah, don't eat Irukandjis. Just trust me. I'm a doctor. Just trust me.
How would you know, though? I mean, I went to a Chinese restaurant the other day, and the specialty dish was duck tongue with jellyfish. Duck tongues are actually quite nice. I didn't try them, though.
So are Irukandji a type of jellyfish, or are they a different genus, a different group?
They fall into a couple of different families, actually. But they all share this weird characteristic of causing what we call Irukandji syndrome, which is the most distressing imaginable thing. It starts out with a mild sting that you barely feel, and sometimes don't even feel at all. And then within about, say, 20 or 30 minutes, typically, but it can be more or less, but usually about 20 or 30 minutes, you start getting severe lower back pain, and it feels like an electric drill drilling into the back. And then within a couple minutes of that starting, you start getting relentless nausea and vomiting. And I don't mean a little bit queasy, like after a Big Mac. I'm saying, sorry, I probably shouldn't have said that. Whoops.
Oh, yes, you can. Go right ahead.
Okay, 10 p.m. time slot. Sorry. But serious, serious vomiting, like, you know, every minute to 2 minutes for, you know, 12 hours. I mean, serious, hardcore vomiting. And then, so you got the back pain going, you got the vomiting going, and then within another couple of minutes, the full force of the syndrome hits, and you are seriously sick. Difficulty breathing, profuse drenching sweating, so much so that the nurses are wringing out the bed sheets every 15 minutes. You're dehydrated because of it.
It's a weight loss method.
More than that. Your whole body's in meltdown. My favorite symptom, by the way, is
favorite
the feeling
symptom.
Of impending doom.
Did you get stung and that's why you're researching this?
No, I was actually researching this. Well, I do research this, but the reason I started was when I was here eons ago on a Fulbright fellowship to study jellyfish fossils and jellyfish blooms, and there were some doctors that brought irukandjis to my attention, and they were absolutely pleading with me. They were saying, you know, we think there's new species. We have no idea. There's nobody with any expertise to figure this out. Please help us. And I really felt, I felt for them. Like, what are you going to do? You know, like, people are dying. People are losing money. People are ruining their vacations. And, you know, so I thought, all right, well, let me look into this. And I really got sucked in because they're just so fascinating. And, you know, here's these little tiny nothingness, invisible things that are just small and essentially meaningless, except for they're hugely important, and they'll absolutely flatten you. You know, not everybody, but a lot of the people stung require life support, or they have ongoing problems like heart damage or neurological damage or, you know, things like this. I mean, it's really serious.
We do have to go to some messages, but can you please stay on the line?
Sure.
And we'll be back in just a short while. You're
you
on
bet.
Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred, and we are talking jellyfish, and we've actually got some messages in about jellyfish. We've got one from Kurt that says, best show ever. I'm fascinated by jellyfish. Blue ones and pink ones get washed up on Altona Beach. I bet they're not irukandji.
Well, no, actually, okay, but before you go thinking that, there was a very, very serious irukandji sting at Queenscliff in 1999. So don't think that you're totally safe. I'm just saying.
Sounds Portuguese man of war to me.
And if it can happen in Ireland, it can happen in Melbourne again. So I'm just saying.
We do have a bit of a theme on this show, which is bringing on guests which tell our listeners the various ways that they're going to
die. They're going to die in Australia.
And how the world will end.
I feel like that we need to put on that Sarah Silverman song, you're all going to die soon, you're going to die soon.
Okay, but see, you're looking at it wrong. You're totally looking at it wrong. It's ways to kill people, not ways to die.
I bet your family never comes and visits you from the US, do they?
No, strangely enough, I never put that together, but no.
Funnily enough, I've got another question to ask you. When I went to Vanuatu one time and I went scuba diving, which I'd never done before, and I said, what about the jellyfish? And they went, oh, we know how to fix that. And I said, how? And they said, you just put stockings on your arms and legs. And it was actually true. Everybody that put pantyhose or stockings on didn't get stung by jellyfish, and everybody that didn't put them on, who all went, oh, I'm not wearing stockings, funnily enough, came out with little red welts all over them from
No, it's true, it's true. Look, for decades, the surf lifesavers used to use stockings to protect themselves from box jellyfish and irukandjis. So they'd wear one pair normally, you know, on the legs, and the other pair, you punch a hole in the crotch and put that over the head and then put the arms through the legs. And it worked really, really well. Of course, now we use Lycra suits instead of stockings, but they both work really, really well to protect.
Why would the stockings work to prevent that? Is it just that it's that small that you can't really get anything through it?
No, it's not that. It's that the jellyfish stinging cells are so tiny. I mean, tiny, tiny microscopic little things. And so what happens is the stockings or the lycra or whatever fabric you have on is enough to keep them away from the skin so that when they fire off, which they will do,
so it's
because
the same
they're mechanically
thing.
Triggered.
The same thing with men with body hair. Some they all often claim that they don't get stung either.
Yeah, but the problem is in the water, the hair isn't matted down in the same way, right? So the trick is to get it so that the you can't get body parts and tentacle bits in between the hairs to get to the to get to the skin. But look, but if you could keep them matted, and by the way, of course, that's what stockings do. So, you know, that works really well. But look, we get dogs that get stung and they're plenty hairy. So,
exactly.
You know, personally, I go with the lycra. I don't look good in lycra. I swear it's like, you know, fashion killer.
You only do it because it reminds you of Palm Springs and the Valley of Enchantment.
I'll have you know, I really like Valley of Enchantment. And my parents ran a head shop. So, you know, that was, I think, you know, it was a formative thing growing up that way.
I'm sorry,
know.
What was the shop?
A head shop? Seriously? You don't know?
What's head shop?
Oh, my God. They sold bongs and roach clothes.
It's legal now. There, not here.
Oh, right. Well, it was legal at the time. You couldn't have the stuff that you would use them for, and you couldn't sell the stuff that you would use them for, but you could sell the things. Right.
Yeah.
So it made no sense.
Yeah, I remember a shop like that in Rockingham, and it was that it would be there, and it's just like it's called something, I can't remember what it was called, but like they sold everything but the wind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sorry, James, you had a question.
Yeah, Lisa. Sorry, we've gone off topic, but I really wanted to ask if you were unlucky enough to get sung, and I suppose this is for other jellyfish as well. I kind of wanted to know whether it's a wives' tale that peeing or putting things that are maybe salty or like vinegar on, are they still considered a good positive thing for after being stung?
Now, I'm going to ask you guys a question because, can I just point out, is nothing sacred?
Okay? No, nothing is sacred.
Nothing is sacred, no.
Yeah, so, okay. I'm going to ask each of you what state your urine is in right now. Is it acidic or alkaline?
Who knows?
It's acidic.
Acidic. Pee is acidic. I'm hoping.
Because if you pee on grass, it kills it. Is that good reasoning?
it's
but you pee on a lemon tree to help because of potassium.
It's right. Nitrogen.
Look, I love it. I love it. Okay, now I'll play along with this too, just so you don't think I'm asking you to do anything I won't do. I actually have no idea what state my urine is in right now. Okay?
But the common myth around jellyfish stings is if you pee on them, it neutralizes the sting.
Okay, but here's the thing. It doesn't. Well, it may be. Okay. So the thing is, if it's in a acidic state, then it will work about 25% as well as vinegar. But if it's in an alkaline state, it will actually force massive discharge of the stinging cells that haven't injected yet to inject their venom into your skin. So it really comes down to the old Clint Eastwood thing, you know, are you feeling lucky?
So all those vinegar bottles that are on the North Queensland beaches are there on purpose, aren't they?
Yeah, so the vinegar works really, really well. The vinegar actually stops the stinging cells that haven't discharged yet from being able to discharge. So that works for box jellies and irukandjis equally well. But we don't tend to use the vinegar outside the tropics because the species that are more likely to kill us are much rarer outside the tropics. But we do get them.
But they are in Ireland.
That's the thing. Yeah, exactly. And look, you know, we've had the irukandji sting in Queenscliff. We've had irukandji stings in Sydney and Perth and Moreton Bay. And, you know, we had a whopper of a boxy sting in Moreton Bay not long ago. You know, we have had some life-threatening stings outside the tropics, but they're very, very rare compared to the types of stings that are merely painful. And, of course, vinegar is not a pain reliever. I mean, you think about what are the pain-relieving qualities of a salad, and it kind of makes it pretty clear, you know.
Yes, if you've got a mouth ulcer, you'll soon find that out.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. So, you know, vinegar does not have pain-relieving qualities, but it may actually save your life, and that's a lot more important, of course.
As always, Lisa, it always feels like we run out of time too early, which is, and you're obviously so passionate about this topic.
Well, it's because jellies are so cool.
They are really cool.
Do you have an aquarium full of them?
No.
In your lounge room?
So you can look at them? My home is decorated as a jellyfish art gallery, and the name of my home is Villa Medusa.
Oh, that's such a great name. And, you know, of course, yeah, because Medusa, I can see that. Well, look, Lisa, thank you so much for being with us this evening. I look forward to being able to have you actually back on the program very shortly. It was lovely to speak with you.
I haven't asked any of the questions I had on my list.
Yeah, I can see. We've got this long list and we just... No, don't be sorry at all. You've been very informative. Thank you so much, Lisa. Have a lovely evening.
You
Thank
too.
You.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You'll certainly find something to your taste on this show tonight. If you haven't been enthralled by jellyfish, you'll be enthralled by our next guest. And our next guest is Paul Woodward. Hello, Paul.
Hey, really and pleased to be here.
Paul is a theatre academic, of all things, who is interested in storytelling. And Paul, tell us what specifically you're interested in and what you're working on at the moment.
So I'm doing a PhD at the moment, and so my background's in theatre, and I'm a HIV positive man, and I was really intrigued coming to Australia, hearing about all these new laws about enforced disclosure before sexual intercourse, and I was really intrigued by the idea that people are being made positive people are being made to
perform.
Disclose well yes perform perform a disclosure, but very little thought or time is sort of placed into what actually makes an effective disclosure. So coming from a theatre background, I just, you know, began to think, well, what have I got in my background that maybe sort of like makes me a more effective discloser? So I began to think about disclosure, HIV disclosure, as a performance in itself. So if I've thought about what I'm going to say before I'm going to say it, is that like a script? Or if I've chosen where I'm going to disclose it, so, you know, is it in a bed, you know, or is it like in a park, you know, on a bench, you know, to what extent am I thinking about it in terms of set, like a theatre set? But also, you know, body language plays a major, major key part in it. It's not just the words saying, I am HIV positive, it's or what your body is doing, or what kind of energy are you approaching that with? And these are all things that we think about, you know, in terms of theatre discourse. But of course, you know, I guess the main thing is the essential actor-audience relationship, you know, and many plays, you know, are based around that moment of disclosure where everything changes.
And this is very intimate theatre you're talking about here, isn't it?
It couldn't be any more intimate, you know, and, you know, like those moments, you know, on stage, you know, Oedipus disclosing, you know, finding out, you know, about his family history, or Hamlet finding out that his father has been killed, you know, by another family member. You know, the great drama is kind of like hinge on that moment of disclosure, and it's about what the protagonist then does. So, you know, I think anyone who's in that disclosure moment is literally caught in the almost existential moment where they can act and do something that changes something and changes their lives, but also to the person that they're disclosing to as well. You know, HIV disclosure is a one-way deal. You know, you can't go back into the closet after you disclose, and very few people are going to make a false disclosure. So the point of the research was just trying to find out, you know, is there anything that I have in my theatre background that can help people make more effective disclosures, that can help people...
Is there enough in this for a PhD? Because a lot of individual disclosures doesn't sound to me like enough data for a PhD.
Well, individual disclosures would be an interesting PhD in itself, but because I'm working in the theatre, you know, I work with groups of people. So I work back in the UK for a gay men's self-development agency called The Quest. And so I look at developing workshop skills around disclosure with men who are both positive and negative, because, you know, a negative disclosure is still a disclosure. And so we create, you know, theatre work based around narrative-based storytelling skills. But I also work in Africa as well. and I've worked in Malawi. I've worked in townships just outside of Cape Town, but most recently in Swaziland. And what I was interested in was to see contextually, like, you know, do people disclose differently? You know, according to context, you know, what are the pressures for people to disclose?
Are there cultural forms of storytelling that affect disclosure? Is a question I would have had.
Yeah, there are. I was struck in Africa, I know, in particular Swaziland, which has such a high prevalence of HIV and such an amazing sort of history of storytelling. I thought that I would have seen, you know, really effective, really empowered disclosures through narrative-based skills, but that actually wasn't the case. I found people less likely to disclose in Swaziland. I think it's because there are so many people that are positive there, and to disclose was meant to receive a lot more discrimination.
We will be talking about this very shortly, continuing talking about this with Paul Woodward. You are on As Nothing Sacred here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on As Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. We're talking with Paul Woodward about HIV disclosure. And Steph, you had a question that you wanted to ask.
I did. I tried to ask during the break, and then I thought some listeners might be interested in the answer as well. So, Paul, you were saying about your work in Africa and working with people around disclosure of HIV status. Mm-hmm. And one thing you mentioned was that people disclose differently in different places, and in somewhere like Swaziland, where there's a large proportion of people who are HIV positive compared to in Australia, that people were less likely to disclose. And I was just wondering if you could talk a bit more about that, and if there's a correlation between the proportion of the population that's HIV positive and the likelihood of disclosure or the response to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised, you know, because I thought that I was going to go to a real hotspot of disclosure, and I thought I was going to have lots of really meaty materials to write about in my research. I'll give you an example of a woman that I was working with called Promise, who was a secondary school teacher equivalent of. When she became positive, which in Swaziland, an unfaithful husband who then left her, you know, with kids, and that's a very typical story, you know, in Africa. She decided that she wasn't going to be quiet about being positive. She said that she was just felt, because she was an educationalist, that there was too much to lose through not disclosing. So she felt, you know, ethically, you know, incumbent to disclose. So she did. And the first thing that happened was she lost her job. So she had to go to the market and sell fruit in a local stall to feed her children. But people wouldn't buy her fruit from the store. People would spit on her fruit. They'd walk past. And the people that were ignoring her walking past, she knew were positive. So it seems to be like one of those things where if there's a high condensation of people who are positive, and then one person stands up and says, well, I am positive, then there's a sense of people wanting to migrate away from, you know, from that figure, you know. So you know, it's just one of those sort of sad situations, you know, where especially a woman can't feel that, you know, they can be empowered to just make that stand and say, I am positive, and that people won't at that point sort of, you know, rally together and say, yes, I am. Because sometimes there can be a domino effect, you know, in disclosure that I'm finding in my research. But you know, not in this case, which is...
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because I would have thought that the African countries have actually got a culture of storytelling, of oral history, that this might somehow be entering into their oral history.
Yeah, it took quite some time to actually coach the people that I was working with to just tell their stories, because fundamentally they were saying, well, we don't have a story. And then, you know, it just took a bit of digging sort of in terms of sort of questioning, in terms of, you know, feeling comfortable in terms of our exchanges. You know, the stories then lay just underneath the surface. But there was a sense of our stories don't matter, because they were living in such an extraordinary time of, you know, death and still grieving, you know, for sometimes whole villages, you know, through loss to AIDS.
But you said before, and I mouthed something at you in the studio, that once you've disclosed, you can't undisclose. But I'd dispute that. Mm-hmm. I think you can undisclose. You can go back into the closet with anything.
It's unlikely that that someone would come out as positive and then say, oh, no, I'm not positive, who would believe that person?
Well, I don't know that it's that. It's about continuing the disclosure.
Mm.
Because one of the things about disclosure, in my experience, is that you have to continue to disclose. Mm. Otherwise, people forget because they don't want to know. And, you know, unless you're sick.
Mm. Mm.
And then they all become inappropriately concerned. But if you don't keep on saying it, if you stay healthy and you look healthy and so on, people just don't notice, and which is my experience.
I'm sorry?
Which is my experience.
Your experience? How so?
Well, when I became positive, which this is disclosing now.
Yes, it is disclosing.
Which was 21 years ago while I was general manager of the Victorian AIDS Council. And I came out as being positive, and I went back into the closet. I stopped disclosing I was positive when I got senior health department jobs.
Why did you go back into the closet?
Because I had senior health department jobs both in New South Wales and Victoria, where I was responsible for both policy and funding of HIV organisations, and the response. And I made an assessment that if I was openly positive, that I would just get everybody that were in positions of political power in the department, you know, demanding that I run any decision I made about HIV past everybody else in the department, because was I actually favouring something for my own personal interest or so on. And so I just chose to give myself the freedom to make the sorts of decisions that I needed to have as a senior bureaucrat, that I was just not going to say anything. So I just didn't say anything, and nobody asked. And the funny thing was that there were people there that I was sure knew, because, you know, when I was general manager of the AIDS Council, I was fairly openly involved in HIV politics.
And I would have assumed that...
So people forgot. They chose to... My view is that there were a number of people who chose just to forget.
Hmm. May I ask a question quickly about your decisions back when you were working in with policy, especially, and you were afraid that people were would assume that you were being biased towards that? Do you sometimes feel that you were favouring that, and not in a bad way? It was wonderful what happened. But
no, I was I wasn't favouring. I'm fairly sure that I used to actually probably self censor a bit. I would say, am I making this correct decision here, and am I doing this for my own interest? There was one time when I thought, I don't want anything to change here, because I had an advantage from a particular policy, but everybody had the advantage. When I looked at it from my own perspective, I wasn't the only person that was being advantaged by the policy. Everybody with HIV was being advantaged by the policy, and so there was no conflict in my mind about that.
I guess I have a bit of a different interpretation, which maybe is wrong, around when you say people choosing to forget. And I was just thinking of an example of when I was in high school and I had an experience where a friend came out to me as gay, and I thought, okay, that's fine. I didn't really feel strongly about it one way or the other. And then I actually promptly forgot, and he had to come out to me again. And I think the reason behind that is because the sort of the default, I'm using quotation marks, or the norm is that people are straight and people are HIV negative, and therefore if you don't in your mind sort of link strongly an association with someone, that in the absence of extra information they sort of go back to the default. So it's about...
But that's
sort
what
of
I
the,
mean about the, yeah, you have to continue to
the invisibility
disclose.
In the same way that, you know, I was talking before about how being white is invisible, being straight is invisible, because it's just, you know, how things are, which is obviously not the reality of the world.
No, I think that's right. I think that that, you know, if you choose not to talk about it, but the great thing about supports in HIV these days is... the best example I can think of in terms of ongoing support, certainly for me, apart from my family, who have been fantastic, but has been an online community called the Institute of Many, TIM, which some people will have heard of. And if anybody was watching a Q&A a few weeks ago, they would have seen Nick Hollis, who was one of the founders of the Institute of Many, on the AIDS 2014 episode of Q&A. And the Institute of Many is an online community for people who are HIV, where people get on and ask questions and post queries and do all sorts of things. And it's actually a really good forum for people to find out about life as a positive person. And there's actually a website as well which HIV negative people can go to, and if they're empathetic enough can join, but can't join the Facebook page.
Obviously, it's for people who are allies towards that.
It's for positive people and their
allies.
And
their allies, yes.
Yeah.
We are running out of time. I'm going to ask just one more question, actually, about this situation especially. And that is, looking back at your work that you did do in senior policy, and, I mean, other than what you said that you had to sometimes self-censor, though, the achievements that have occurred from that, though, do you think that you would change anything?
Oh, there'd be a few things that I would do differently now, but that's in hindsight.
Hindsight's a magnificent.
Hindsight is a fantastic thing. There are some things that I would have changed. There were some things that I'd reevaluate, and there are some.
In particular, with regard to HIV.
Yeah, with regard to HIV, and there would be some people that I would move on.
I'd like to ask about how do you feel now after disclosing on air? It's a very brave thing to do. How do you feel now?
I feel quite relaxed about it, actually.
We're among friends.
But, you know, I have chosen to disclose amongst my myriad of legion of fans out there, but in a studio full of people that are fairly supportive of me and have been for other things in my life, in my opinion. So the fact is that, you know, we're all friends, and I've had a supportive family. I've got kids, and I had to tell them when I first seroconverted, because, you know, when I seroconverted, it was you've got 2 to 5 years to live, which, you know, when you've got an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, you sort of have to tell them, because they need to be prepared for what might happen, which might not be quite nice. Especially in those days, it wasn't nice. Dying of AIDS was not a happy thing.
I do have one more question, actually, for Paul, or maybe Jim, you can jump in with this as well. So, you know, Jim, having you had your experience of continuously coming out, and Paul having spoken to lots of people, and you were talking before about the setting and the script, if there is anyone listening who is HIV positive and is looking for advice in coming out as HIV positive, what advice would you both have for them?
Talk to someone else who's positive. Get the sort of community support that you need to have, and find out about, you know, get the information. I think the information is power in this arena.
Yeah, and I think how you disclose is really important. You know, you're not just saying, you know, what your medical status is. You're also saying, how accepting am I of my status? So I think that if you disclose to someone important to you and you're feeling fearful, or if you're feeling anxious, then that's what's going to be communicated, you know, fear and anxiety around HIV. But if you really sort of have thought about it, and you've talked to other people about it, and you know kind of what your script is, and you know that you're at ease with it, then that feeling, you know, of acceptance will hopefully make the other person feel at ease as well. And so that dispels sort of elements of fear and stigma.
We do have one last message for the evening before we have to leave today, which comes from Dean Beck. Congratulations, which is not the right word, Jim, for taking such a big personal step tonight. Your leadership and intellect will continue to inspire our community with less double thinking and more authenticity from this day forth. Glad I was listening, D.
Aww.
Thank you very much, Dean.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening this evening, listeners. This is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. Thank you very much, Paul, for joining us this evening. Thank you, Jim.
And we will be podcasting this.
Definitely podcasting this
one. I know. I've spoken to our podcaster, James, already today, and he knows that there's a show that needs some empathetic
he knew
podcasting.
That, yeah. Thank you so much this evening, Steph and James. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
And thank you so much to Lisa Gershwin for her excellent interview about jellyfish, which was hilarious. And we're very much
looking
forward.
It's a stingingly good show tonight.
Stingingly good show. And we're looking forward to having her back again.
Coming up next is Lady and the Camp. Thank you very much, listeners. You've been listening to Is Nothing Sacred here on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy.
Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.